Before steel pans rang through Port of Spain, before Carnival became a global celebration, there was sugar and suffering. There were songs whispered in cane fields, lullabies of pain, coded rhythms of revolt. This is the story of how the Caribbean transformed its torment into art, its silence into sound, and its oppression into rhythm. From the fire of slavery to the freedom of Calypso, discover the untold journey that reshaped the soul of the islands. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Fields of Fire, the Sugar Empire. Before music, before Carnival, before Calypso, there was sugar and blood. The Caribbean, as the world knows it today, was forged not in celebration, but in chains. It began with a crop so sweet it soured the soul of empires. In the 17th and 18th centuries, sugar was gold. White gold. The European appetite for sweetness had become insatiable, and no place fed it more ruthlessly than the Caribbean. Across the islands, fields of sugarcane stretched endlessly beneath the burning sun, a green sea waving with deceptive grace. But within those stalks, something darker grew. Beneath the rustle of leaves and the hum of cicadas was the crack of whips, the cries of the enslaved, and the silent rebellion of stolen souls. They came in chains, from the coasts of West Africa, from kingdoms and villages swallowed by war, deception, and profit. They were not just laborers. They were mothers, drummers, blacksmiths, griots, warriors. And they were turned into property. The plantation was a machine. Brutal. Efficient. Designed to break the body and erase the self. Days began before sunrise with the blowing of a conch shell. A sound that once summoned freedom in Africa, now called the enslaved to toil. Men, women, and children worked from dawn to dusk, their hands slashed by cane blades, their backs scarred by overseers' lashes. To fall behind was to be whipped. To resist was to be made an example. To escape was to face death, or worse. The mills that crushed cane into sugar ran on human suffering. The boiling houses reeked of fire and flesh, where men worked in choking heat, stoking flames beneath copper vats. Every pound of sugar packed into barrels and shipped to Europe came at the cost of a life, or many. Yet amid this horror, something extraordinary happened. The enslaved did not vanish into silence. They remembered. They resisted. In whispered languages and hidden dances, they preserved what they could. When the drum was outlawed, they turned to the body, to claps, to feet, to rhythm encoded in movement. When their gods were forbidden, they wore the masks of saints. In their suffering, they planted seeds of culture, of identity, of defiance. Sugar built the Caribbean economy, but it also laid the foundation for something it could never contain, spirit. The Maroons fled to the mountains and built free societies. Revolts flared in plantations from Jamaica to Saint-Domingue. And in the midnight gatherings, in the yards, the barracks, the underbellies of oppression, something began to stir. A sound, a vibration, a rhythm no whip could crush. This was the beginning of the long arc, from field to festival, from chain to chant. But before the song could rise, the fire had to burn. And it burned bright in the sugar fields, a crucible of pain and prophecy. Because every note of Calypso that would one day echo in the streets began right here, where the sweet taste of sugar masked the bitterness of a stolen world. Songs of survival, the soundtrack of resistance. They tried to silence them, tried to erase their language, their gods, their names. But the rhythm remained. Even in the darkest hours of slavery, the Caribbean was never truly quiet. Beneath the lash and the labor, beneath the sugar mill's groan and the overseer's orders, there was always sound. Not noise, but coded memory. The beat of survival. For the enslaved, music was more than expression. It was resistance. Across the Caribbean, African traditions were torn from the soil, but not from the soul. The drum was their first weapon and their last refuge. In the Congo Square of New Orleans, in the cane fields of Barbados, in the backyards of Trinidad, enslaved Africans drummed their stories. Even when the colonial authorities outlawed drums, fearing their use to signal revolts, the music did not die. It adapted. Hands slapped against wooden boxes. Feet stomped out coded steps. Tongues shaped new languages from broken ones, creoles born of trauma and survival. And through it all, a secret symphony unfolded. Music became a map to lost homelands. A spiritual anchor. A whispered prayer in motion. The songs sung in the night were not always loud, but they carried weight, In Jamaica, Kumina and Nyabingi drumming carried the echoes of Congo and Ethiopia. In Haiti, the ritual rhythms of Vodou preserved West African cosmologies beneath a Catholic disguise. In Trinidad, chantwells, the early griots of Calypso, developed a sharp, rhythmic form of lyrical storytelling. They mocked slave masters in coded verses, told news through song, and passed down ancestral knowledge through melody. Even the lullabies had double meanings, gentle on the surface, rebellious underneath. Lyrics cloaked in metaphor warned of danger, honored the dead, and remembered forbidden names. This was cultural camouflage, not surrender, but strategy. To sing was to survive, to remember, to mourn, and to warn. Music passed messages that could not be spoken, a melody meant to gather, a rhythm that meant flee. The music itself became a form of resistance, not only spiritual but practical. In the revolts that shook the region, from the Takis War in Jamaica to the Haitian Revolution, music was the signal and the soul of uprising. But this was more than rebellion. It was rebirth. Even as families were separated and identities shattered, music held the fragments together. In the dirt floors of barracks, they danced. In the silence after a beating, they hummed. In the moonlit hush of forbidden gatherings, they sang to the ancestors and to themselves. Because where there is rhythm, there is memory. And where there is memory, there is hope. The Caribbean's great cultural movements did not begin in parliaments or on stages. They began here, in the unrecorded harmonies of the enslaved, who made music not for applause, but for survival. They turned grief into cadence, rage into ritual, and silence into song. These were the first notes of what would one day become Calypso. But first, they were the soundtrack of survival. Freedom with chains, post-emancipation, and identity crisis. The chains were broken, but the wounds remained. Emancipation swept across the Caribbean in the 1830s like a long-awaited promise. Bells rang, documents were signed, and the empire declared its former slaves free. But freedom, for the Caribbean's African descendants, came with a cruel sleight of hand. There were no reparations, no land, no safety net, only broken families, unpaid generations, and a society still structured to benefit the planter class. The plantation system didn't die, it adapted. Across Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, and the wider British West Indies, newly emancipated Africans were told they must now work, for wages so low they mimicked slavery. The same sugar fields stood waiting. The same overseers watched. The whip had vanished from public view, but its spirit lingered in every contract, every pay cut, every beating hidden behind plantation walls. Meanwhile, the colonial elite, fearing economic collapse and black vengeance, imported new waves of indentured laborers from India, China, and Madeira. These workers arrived under binding contracts, promised freedom after years of toil, but often caught in cycles of abuse and poverty. What emerged was a volatile mosaic, African traditions rubbing against Indian rituals, Chinese philosophies meeting Yoruba cosmology, European governance clashing with indigenous roots. Out of this tension, something remarkable began to form, a Caribbean identity stitched from contradiction and survival. But that identity did not come easily. The colonial governments policed culture just as they had policed bodies. African drumming was still feared. Folk religions were outlawed or demonized. Carnival was seen as a threat to European morality. Language itself became a battleground, with English, French, and Spanish imposed as the languages of progress, while Creole tongues were ridiculed as ignorant and savage. Still, the people persisted. In Trinidad, newly freed Africans and Indian immigrants began to reshape the barrack yards, once symbols of control, into vibrant hubs of cultural exchange. African rituals fused with Hindu festivals. Creole patois absorbed Hindi words. Instruments crossed lines. So did resistance. Music was no longer just about survival. It was becoming about self-expression. Enter the chantwell, the poetic vocalist who sang truth to power in public spaces. These early Calypsonians challenged elites, exposed scandals, and celebrated black consciousness long before the term existed. Their verses carried laughter, pain, and political fire. And though the British tried to suppress them, banning drums, restricting street gatherings, the spirit could not be silenced. The people had found a voice that no decree could erase. They had endured slavery. Now they would endure false freedom. And in doing so, they would give birth to a new Caribbean culture, one that would soon explode in rhythm, masquerade, and lyrical defiance. But first, they had to learn to dance in the ruins. to make music not from triumph, but from trauma, to reclaim a body once enslaved, a land still colonized, and a soul still searching for home. This was not yet Calypso, but the road was being paved, with broken shackles, borrowed rhythms, and the defiant spark of identity under siege. The rise of Calypso, lyrics, laughter, and liberation. From the baroque yards of Port of Spain, a sound rose, sharp, clever, unshackled. It wasn't gospel. It wasn't opera. It was something else. Something born of fire and laughter, irony and pain. It was Calypso. By the early 20th century, Trinidad was a mosaic of contradictions. A colonial society where African, Indian, Chinese, and European cultures collided daily, and where the echoes of slavery still lingered beneath the surface of sugar and oil economies. Yet in the backyards, in the stick-fighting arenas, and on the carnival roads, a new cultural force was emerging. The Chantwell had evolved. No longer just a storyteller of oral tales or baroque yard gossip, the Chantwell, often women in its earliest form, became a vocal warrior. With biting wit and a rhythm that danced on the edge of defiance, they gave voice to the voiceless. They sang about injustice, corruption, heartbreak, immigration, black pride, and colonial hypocrisy. These lyrics were not merely entertainment, they were journalism in disguise. News traveled through song. Truths censored in newspapers were laid bare in melody. Calypso was the Caribbean's musical newspaper, part protest, part satire, part carnival. By the 1930s and 40s, Calypso had taken firm root in the cultural soil of Trinidad, spreading to Grenada, Barbados, Guyana, and beyond. Figures like Lord Executor, Attila the Hun, and Roaring Lion stepped into the spotlight, bringing charisma, commentary, and culture to the stage. They wore sharp suits and wielded sharper lyrics. Their calypsos tackled colonial education policies, price gouging, police violence, and the struggles of everyday life. Then came the Calypso tent, not a literal tent at first, but a metaphorical stage, a sacred ground for truth-telling. Inside, musicians stood before the people, their words wrapped in rhythm, their melodies masking revolution. The colonial authorities watched nervously. They tried censorship, licensing, police raids. But how do you arrest a metaphor? Every time Calypso was pushed down, it rose, funnier, sharper, braver. By the time the Mighty Sparrow and Lord Kitchener arrived in the 1950s, Calypso had become unstoppable. Sparrow's Jean and Dinah wasn't just about women of the night. It was a commentary on American imperialism in the Caribbean. Kitchener's London is the Place for Me told the bittersweet story of Caribbean migration with swagger and soul. Calypso was both mirror and weapon, reflecting the world, reshaping the mind. The British may have ruled the Caribbean, but Calypsonians ruled the streets. They created new heroes. They turned scandals into sing-alongs. And they laid the groundwork for a musical legacy that would soon birth soca, reggae, and dancehall. But Calypso was always more than music. It was memory, satire, resistance, and ritual. It turned the pain of the past into punchlines. It gave the oppressed a way to smile, with teeth bared. And in the echo of every steel pan, in the bend of every bass line, you could still hear the old stories of sugar, of survival, and of spirit unbroken. Because Calypso did not come from luxury. It came from struggle. And it taught the Caribbean not only how to speak, but how to sing back to power. Carnival as resistance, the moss behind the mask. To the outsider, it was just a party. Costumes, feathers, glittering skin, bodies in motion. But to the Caribbean soul, carnival was something else entirely. It was protest. It was memory. It was survival wrapped in rhythm and masquerade. The origins of carnival in the Caribbean are tangled, like the islands themselves, a mix of European pageantry and African spirituality. The French and Spanish colonizers brought their pre-Lenten masquerades, masked balls, courtly parades, and aristocratic excess. But the enslaved, watching from the shadows, were already reshaping it. They saw the masks and understood them. They had been forced to wear their own, of obedience, of silence. But in the stolen hours, in the backyards and barracks, they created their own carnival. They mocked the masters. They imitated their dress, their pomp, their language, not to honor, but to subvert. They danced not in ballrooms, but in the dirt, barefoot, sweating, unbroken. After emancipation, carnival exploded from the plantations into the streets. No longer a parody from the margins, it became a movement. And behind every character, every Moko Jumbi towering on stilts, every blue devil writhing in paint, every jab-jab dragging chains, was a story the colonizers never meant to survive. The Jab Malassi wore chains not for style, but as remembrance of slavery. The baby doll mocked colonial morality and the policing of black women's bodies. The Pierrot Grenade used sharp tongue and satire to tear apart the hypocrisy of colonial education and class. This was not entertainment. This was spiritual rebellion. And then came the rhythm, the drumbeat that no empire could erase. The streets pulsed with sound, tambu bamboo, then iron bands, and finally steel pan, born from oil drums in Trinidad's poorest neighborhoods. The music, like the people, rose from what was discarded, forged from oppression, tuned into liberation. Carnival became a canvas for Calypso, too. The Chantwells, now Calypsonians, walked the parade routes like prophets, singing the year's joys and injustices. And as the crowds danced, they also remembered, even if they didn't say it out loud. Because Carnival was never just about joy. It was about taking space, about reclaiming the streets that were once closed to black feet, about shouting the names of ancestors in rhythm so loud, even history couldn't ignore them. The colonial authorities tried to control it. They imposed curfews, banned drumming, sent police into the crowds. But Carnival only grew, wilder, wiser, louder. By the mid-20th century, Carnival had become the heartbeat of resistance across the region. From Trinidad to Grenada, from St. Lucia to Jamaica, the spirit spread. Each island shaped it in its own way, but the root was always the same, defiance in disguise. Even today, Carnival is often misunderstood by outsiders, seen as spectacle, not substance. But for those who know, who feel the ground shake beneath the rhythm, who see the ancestors in the costumes, who recognize the poetry in the performance, it is sacred. It is protest in paint. It is history in feathers. It is the soul of a people dancing through their scars. Because Carnival was never just a celebration. It was and still is resistance. From Calypso to the world, the diaspora echo. The islands could not contain it. What began in the cane fields and carnival yards, born from pain, rebellion, and rhythm, soon took flight. Calypso had been the Caribbean's secret weapon. But now, the world was beginning to hear its echo. By the 1950s and 60s, the winds of migration swept thousands of Caribbean men and women to new shores. They boarded ships like the Empire Windrush, leaving behind the tropics for the gray skies of Britain, the cold tenements of Canada, and the sprawling boroughs of New York. They carried little, but they carried their sound. And the sound carried them. In London's Brixton and Birmingham, Caribbean migrants faced hostility, racism, and isolation. But they brought with them the lifeblood of home, the steel pan, the calypso tent, the carnival road. In basements and community halls, in churchyards and living rooms, they sang. They taught their children the verses of Lord Kitchener and Mighty Sparrow, not just for melody, but for memory. Calypso became a lifeline, a way to hold on, to speak truth in a foreign tongue. And soon it began to evolve. In Trinidad, the frenetic pulse of soca began to rise, faster, louder, engineered for dancing. Artists like Lord Shorty, Arrow, and Moshel Montano modernized the genre, blending East Indian percussion, African bass lines, and global pop influences into a new, irresistible force. Carnival stages pulsed with a new energy, as thousands moved not just to the beat, but to the history buried beneath it. Meanwhile, in Jamaica, the calypso tradition gave way to another revolution, reggae. Where calypso had once narrated the struggles of the working class, reggae spiritualized them. It took the legacy of resistance and infused it with Rastafarianism, African identity, and political fire. Bob Marley's voice, born in Nine Mile and nurtured in Trench Town, became a global sermon. From Redemption Song to Get Up, Stand Up, the rhythms of rebellion spread from Kingston to the corners of the earth. And beyond reggae, new forms emerged: dancehall, dub, hip-hop, Afrobeats, each carrying a piece of the Caribbean's cultural DNA, echoing the same cry. We are still here. We were never conquered. We speak in sound. In Brooklyn, Toronto, and London, new generations of Caribbean youth shaped these genres into their own stories. Artists like Nicki Minaj, Rihanna, and Drake, descendants of island rhythms, took Caribbean cadence to the top of global charts. But the music always remembered its roots. Even in stadiums and Super Bowls, even in sold-out arenas and world tours, the echoes of the Canefield chants and Chantwell verses remained. They were the foundation, the buried melody, the ancestral code beneath the bass. The Caribbean had always been global, even when it was enslaved, colonized, dismissed. Now the world danced to its beat, and Calypso, once confined to street corners and carnival tents, had become a global ambassador of a people who turned slavery into song, chains into chords, and pain into poetry. The diaspora carried more than culture. It carried resilience. And wherever a steel pan rang out in Brooklyn, wherever a soca beat shook a London parade, wherever a reggae lyric lit fire in the heart of a rebel youth, the Caribbean was speaking again, loud, proud, unbroken. Legacy and reverberations, the cultural engine of the islands. History echoes loudest in rhythm. The Caribbean, once chained by empires and carved by sugar, now moves the world to its own beat. But the journey was never just about music. It was about survival, reinvention, defiance. And what the Caribbean created in response to its suffering is nothing short of a cultural miracle. Today, the sound of the Caribbean is everywhere. In the booming bass of Afrobeats, in the syncopated swing of reggaeton, in the chants of protesters, the crescendos of carnivals, the hooks in top 40 hits. What was once mocked or outlawed is now exported, celebrated, copied, commercialized. And yet, within every melody, every masquerade, every mic drop, the original pulse remains. A memory encoded in sound. A people refusing to be forgotten. Calypso's influence didn't fade. It evolved. It gave birth to entire genres. It fueled revolutions. It trained poets. It became the platform for Black pride, Caribbean feminism, anti-colonial critique, and diaspora connection. From the fiery Calypso tents of Port of Spain to the digital soundscapes of modern streaming platforms, the Caribbean's voice has grown louder, sharper, and more urgent. But its core remains sacred. Because Calypso is not just a style, it is a language of resistance. Carnival is not just a party, it is a political reclaiming of space. Steel pan is not just an instrument, it is the alchemy of pain into harmony. Each of these is a cultural engine, driving the Caribbean forward while holding its past intact. And that engine is still running. Today's Caribbean youth carry a dual burden, to preserve and to innovate, to honor the ancestors and still forge something new. And they do it not in silence, but in remix. They sample Sparrow and speak in soca. They drop dancehall bars over trap beats. They wear moss with political statements painted across their backs. They are the children of Calypso, whether they sing or not. And they are the legacy of a journey that began not with music, but with screams in the cane fields. This is what the Caribbean has always done. Turn bondage into brilliance. Turn loss into lyric. Turn silence into soul. From sugar to Calypso, from blood to beat, from despair to defiance. This is the untold journey of a people who could not be broken. And even now, long after the cane has been cut, long after the empires have faded, the rhythm still rises. Because the Caribbean doesn't just remember history, it dances with it.